And welcome to CSIS on this occasion of a book launch by an old friend and former colleague of mine who is now with MAPI. And so my welcome is on behalf of CSIS, but you're going to hear from the MAPI part of this hosting team very shortly. For those of you who are new to CSIS, my name is Tasey Schaefer, and I'm the South Asia Program Director at CSIS. This is a somewhat unusual venture because we haven't, at least my program hasn't, done an awful lot of book projects that were in association with another institution. But when Ernie and I first began talking about this project about a year and a half ago, the idea that turned me on was his proposal to take a deeper look at where India was coming in becoming, as he put it, an advanced technology superstate. You know, I'm going to let him tell you the story of what he found, and then I will have an opportunity later on to compare that with some of the work we've done, also looking at India from a somewhat broader perspective. But certainly this is one of the issues of the world that is emerging as we speak. And the focus of his book, which involves looking at both at China and at India, is certainly central to what Asia is going to be like in the coming decade and beyond. So I'm delighted to have you all here. I bring you personal greetings from John Hamry, our president, who unfortunately was not able to be with us today, but who is with us in spirit. And let me pass the microphone to Tom Duesterberg and let him welcome you on behalf of MAPI.
Thank you, Tasey. For those of you who don't know the Manufacturers Alliance very well, we are a business think tank formed 75 years ago as a result of the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was made famous in constitutional history of the United States by virtue of the fact that the Supreme Court struck down the organizing statute about a year and a half after it was put into place. But we were the business league for the machinery industry, and the leaders of the machinery industry found it useful to get together and talk about various issues, and we've been in business ever since. Our primary business is executive education, and we also do a fair amount of economic research and forecasting. We have 500 member companies. We have over 2,200 senior executives who come out to our meetings every year. I'm pleased that we were able to work with Ambassador Schaefer and CSIS on this project. This is Ernie Prieg's second book on China. He's expanding the topic quite a bit to take into account the emergence of India and the new dynamics, the global dynamics that result from that. So the program today was Ernie will present an overview of the book. Then after that, we have three distinguished commentators to give a perspective on the book. Then we'll throw it open to your questions. But it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ernie Prieg, who has been with the Manufacturers Alliance for 7 or 8 years. And I'm proud to say that this is his fourth book for us. May we all be as productive in our second careers as Ernie has been in his second career as a as an analyst. All told, this is Ernie's 20th book that he's either written or edited. Ernie had a distinguished career as a Foreign Service officer between 1963 and 1988. Highlights were his last posting as chief economist and deputy administrator at AID. He was our ambassador to Haiti. And Ernie is always proud to emphasize that he was a a merchant marine officer for the first 5 years of his career before getting a PhD from the New School in economics. So this is a topic of great interest to our member companies. China and India are manufacturing superpowers, and Ernie has illuminated in a very broad way the rise of these two nations, what it means for the United States and what it means for the global international economy. So, Ernie.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you all for coming here today. Let me say, first of all, that the subject of the study, the technology-driven transformation of the global economy with China and India rising to play central roles, should certainly be worth your time here today. Whether and how fully I have been able to come to grips with the many issues involved is for you to judge, but I will only say that all these books Tom mentioned, for me, no question, this has been the biggest challenge of mine. Lengthy experience now in policy analysis. It's even been a challenge as to how to summarize the key issues in the limited time available here now. There is a fairly lengthy listing of the principal analytic findings and policy recommendations in Chapter 1, starting on page 11 to be precise, but I felt going through those and elaborating wouldn't be the best way to do what I'm trying to do, to give a central thrust for how I've come out. So what I'm doing instead, first I'm going to make a few comments on the sort of the big picture of this global technology-driven transformation, and then I'm going to give you answers to what are three central questions that are addressed in the study. And my big picture point of departure is the assessment. That's the title. Is the assessment that in fact India and China are emerging advanced technology superstates, namely that they are nations that will almost certainly achieve great economic, technological, and financial status, that will very likely become financially and politically powerful international affairs, and that will inevitably strive to become military superpowers as well. And toward achieving such superstate status, both countries, of course, over a billion in population, growth rates in recent years, 8 to 11% GDP, exports growing 25% or more per year, almost all in manufacturers, business services, research and development expenditures since 2000, growing 19% a year in China, 11% in India, compared with 4% in the U.S., Europe, and Japan. And both are busily engaged in military modernization on a big scale, driven very much by deepening integration between defense industry and these new advanced technology civil industries. Now, China is 5 or 10 years ahead of India in most respects, but India, particularly in recent years, is ahead in a few areas and closing the gap in others. Increasing competition for foreign direct investment, particularly those with big R&D programs involved. Growing competition on exports, not only business services where India is well out in front, but in manufacturers where India is coming on strong, particularly the last 2 years. And even military modernization, where China is clearly well ahead of India, India is moving forward in some areas significantly. For example, India is building its first aircraft carrier in India, in addition to the two that are already afloat, whereas China is still at the planning stage, getting near the. So that's just an example. Now, in broader international terms, this rapid technology-driven transformation in the two nations that comprise a third of the global population is leading to fundamental change in the world economic and political orders. This new world order will increasingly focus on will be driven by these three advanced, soon or existing advanced technology superstates, plus the EU, which is an advanced technology superpower, but not a state with a unified military and foreign policy. And they will more and more come to dominate world political and economic power. Just in terms of GDP, in terms of size, measured comparably on a purchasing power parity or PPP basis, as of last year, China was about half the size of the U.S. economy and on track to be on parity with us in about 10 years. Last year also, India passed Germany to become the fourth largest economy, on track to pass Japan to be number three in about 5 to 7 years. These four advanced technology superpowers, moreover, are the economic hegemon, the dominant driving power in their respective regions, North America, West Europe, East Asia, South Asia. And these regions, which are integrating, and they're really four advanced technology regions, are what is really shaping up the new international structure. These four advanced technology regions account, it's no longer East versus West or North versus South in the world. It's the four leading edge advanced technology regions moving ahead, and the rest of the world, which is behind and interacting in various ways, which is discussed at length in the final chapter, I should say. These four regions account for 70% of the global population, over 80% of global GDP and exports. They account for 90% of global military expenditures and 95% of R&D expenditures. And all of those percentages, except population, are going to go up further in the next decade because of this rapid technology-driven growth in Asia and China and India most of all. So, and incidentally, these percentage figures on the regions and countries are elaborated in more detail, if you're interested, in Table 11.1 on page 268, to be precise. So that's what is, which I call the brave new advanced technology world in the dedication page. And obviously it has very big, major challenges for U.S. policy, which half the book is about. The immediate challenge is to restore U.S. export competitiveness, quite frankly, and manufacturers in particular, and to maintain our longstanding leadership in technological innovation, both being challenged greatly by China, India, and other Asians in particular. A broader economic challenge is reform of the international finance and trading systems, IMF and WTO, which are basically dysfunctional these days, and for which China and India will be decisive if any reforms are to be forthcoming. This issue is elaborated at considerable length in two annexes to chapters 8 and 9, but I won't get into it here. There's also a growing challenge to the U.S. military position, power position in Asia, mainly vis-a-vis China, but with India playing a growing factor in the equation. Again, an example, Tom mentioned it, reflecting my being a former naval person. In the next 10 years, there's going to be deepening interaction among the three blue water fleets, U.S., China, and India, the Pacific through Malacca Straits, Bay of Bengal, Indian Ocean. It's going to happen. It's already beginning to happen. But the three fleets are, at this stage, basically on very uncertain courses into what I would call largely uncharted policy waters. Finally, and the most important foreign policy challenge for the United States, a political or foreign policy challenge, is to bridge the great political divide between the two largest democracies and the largest authoritarian state, China. And there'll be a world of difference. Or perhaps I should say, there'd be a very different world order if the three advanced technology superstates and military superpowers are all democracies based on rule of law, individual freedom, rather than this 2-to-1 divide we have. There's a lot about that in the book, including recommendations how the U.S. can be more supportive of democratization in China, but again, I'm not going to get into it here. This is the big picture. Many forces in play. There's no facile, simple explanation of what's going on in these two countries. I found that out. And there's no simple silver bullet U.S. policy response. And certainly the poison bullet protectionist response is only going to have more adverse impact on U.S. foreign policy as well as economic commercial interests. So now let me turn to the three questions that I mentioned. And they are, what have been the distinguishing characteristics of Indian and Chinese economic performance over the past 2 to 3 years? What is the likely economic course ahead for the two countries over the next 2 to 5 years? And what should be the U.S. policy response? The short answer to the first question, both nations have been experiencing very high economic growth, but on largely different growth paths. India has been balanced, predominantly private sector-driven growth, while China has had excessively export-oriented growth with a much larger government role. The India path, 8 to 9% growth, it's been 7% growth in consumption, 15% investment, the external accounts more or less staying in balance, a rising deficit in merchandise trade, a rising surplus in services trade. But it's been strong and wide-ranging entrepreneurial leadership that has been the driving force and gaining momentum, including the rise of Indian multinational companies in a number of sectors just during these last couple of years. The government, in contrast, the Indian government supports this, but is moving forward slowly, unevenly, limited financial reserves, at an impasse on many issues because of the coalition government in opposition. In fact, though, something that's a little harder to understand or see is that many of this, or some of the steps forward are more by stealth than public proclamation in reform. And I'll give you two examples that are important, recent ones. The first, in February 06, just when I began thinking about this, a greatly liberalized policy law for special economic zones, SEZs, free trade zones, free of the government bureaucracy, was passed with little fanfare. And then 6 months later, it came out that there had been 400 applications and 200 approvals of SEZs. Then the reaction fell in. The opposition and some demonstrations, there was some violence in West Bengal. The law was amended a little bit, particularly and wisely, to make sure that farmers and others displaced would get generous payments. But the momentum continues. And in 07, 1 year later, 40 of these SEZs are in production with $10 billion of exports, manufacturers for the most part. And this year they're projecting $20 to $25 billion. I mean, it's, and it just kind of emerged. And the other example of by stealth is that there is deepening competition among states, as happened earlier in China, to attract job-creating investment, including for urgently need infrastructure projects. But they're not changing this heavy regulatory framework or the laws. It's behind doors where the investor discusses with the state government how the regulations will be applied, how to make them more investment-friendly and respond to specific requests. And it's happening all over the place. It varies by state, but even the two communist states of West Bengal and Kerala, they're into this competition, and with success. They've got their industrial parks and their new investments and their new electric power and all this stuff coming in. So the overall recent performance is balanced high growth but gathering momentum from this private sector drive. Recent Chinese growth, quite different, even higher at 10 to 11% the last couple of years, but includes much larger financial and other incentives from the government to the private sector to investors, particularly for the rapid development of advanced technology industries. However, two threatening clouds have come up over these past couple of years that cast a lot of doubt about where it's going at this stage. The first is this extraordinary surge in the current account surplus, so export-oriented, and something has to be done, and I'll come back to that. That's the third question, actually. The second dark cloud, though, is the new Chinese economic strategy of independent or indigenous innovation, launched in January 06, and intended to give strong preference to Chinese over foreign-invested firms for the development of science and technology. It's basically economic nationalism, a reversal of the earlier policy, which gave preferences to foreign firms. It's a very elaborate, there's all kinds of objectives and industries being implemented. They're spelled out in some detail, incidentally, on pages 29 to 31 of the book. It's unclear how fast and how far this is going to be pursued, but certainly foreign investors are concerned about it. And you'll see there are several references, most recent December 07 annual USTR report to the Congress. That's explained in Chapter 8, a number of references to this is threatening. And what's going to happen next is not clear, except that new investors looking at China might have doubts about it and might be looking elsewhere, including to India, quite frankly, to go with some of the new investment, in particular in these advanced industries. So this is a dimension of the subtitle of the book, An Advanced Technology Race, which again I already alluded to at the outset. These are the broad lines of what's been happening. In the book, there's examined in some detail the comparative performance in all the key areas in education, you know, engineers, scientists, and R&D, in technological innovation by sector, the rise of indigenous MNCs, foreign direct investment, trade. And trade, in many ways, is leading edge, because first of all, we have the most up-to-date, the most detailed statistics by sector, by product, and also it's a direct measure of export competitiveness, which is a major U.S. interest engaged at this stage. So I want to finish this first answer with three tables of recent developments that are quite important in terms of what's happening with trade. The first is this dramatic surge of China to pass the U.S. by and become the number one exporter of manufacturers. This is not from the book, it's from that commentary handout today. It's discussed in the book, but this commentary is some op-ed is inbox at this stage. I mean, and anyhow, here you see in 2000, 7 years ago, U.S. exports three times larger than Chinese, 690 to 224. And then last year, China has surged well ahead of its 1.2 trillion versus 982. It'll be even wider this year. At the same time, trade surplus in China, tenfold increase from 45 to 444, while the U.S. deficit in manufacturers, already very large, 324, is now up at about 500 billion. Also, as described in the text, now the large majority of Chinese exports and the big growth sectors are the high technology sectors. It's no longer the labor intensive stuff. The recent development, this is the India-China competition. It's the exports of business services, which constitutes the big bulk of the bottom half of the table, other commercial services. And here you have India in 3 years tripling its exports and passing China by in the process. In 06, 58.3 billion for India versus 36.5 for China. Indian exports, business service, over 30% a year. They're probably at 100 billion this year. Also, as you see, bottom right corner, the trade balance. India, a surging trade surplus up to 26.9 2 years ago, where China is in small 5 billion deficit. And the final table, this is bilateral U.S. trade with India and China in advanced technology products, ATP. These are the products that have the highest R&D and engineering content. It's about 25% of total U.S. trade and manufacturers. And here again, you see the dramatic surge in the deficit with China from 11.8 billion in 2002 to 67.7 billion last year, with about a 4-to-1 ratio. And obviously, this is a great concern in terms of U.S. objective maintaining export competitiveness in high-tech industry and technological innovation. India, on the other hand, as you see, much smaller trade and a growing U.S. surplus, up to $7.4 billion last year, which was mostly thanks to the Boeing Corporation, I should say. So that's where I am on the first question. Let me now move to question two, next 2 to 5 years. And here the short answer is, it is highly likely that India will continue its 8% to 10% annual growth, while China is equally likely to experience a hard landing adjustment to more domestically oriented growth, including slower growth for at least a couple of years. Now, quite frankly, these projections were not anticipated when I started this study almost 2 years ago, and they are based both on the very sharp contrast in the macroeconomic trends in the two countries and on examination, I won't go into detail, but on 8 particular issues that will be decisive for the outcome of these projections. It's also based on a key assumption that sometime over the next 2, 3, 4 years, China is going to have to take strong actions, including a major revaluation of its currency, in order to level off and begin to have a decline in its current account surplus and the related central bank purchases of foreign exchange, which were $462 billion last year, several times larger than anything in the history of the IMF. So that assumption is built in. If that doesn't happen, there's a whole other scenario that I won't get into today for sure. The macroeconomic trends, really graphic, stark terms, I can show in 4 charts, which are in the key chapter 5 we're talking about now. The first is current account balance as a percentage of GDP. And here you have China going 4% in 2002, which is already considered high, up to 9% in 2006, and an estimated 12% last year. And it's going to go higher this year, almost certainly. Nothing like that in the history of IMF or a major trading nation. Whereas in India, it's much closer to balance. There's a 2 to 3% of GDP current account deficit, offset, more than offset, by an inflow of long-term investment. Second chart, domestic investment as a share of GDP. And here India is up from 24% to, I believe it's 25 to 34%. That's the private sector, the surge in private sector investment. And that's just about right, 34%, to finance 8 to 10% growth. These numbers are related. So that's a very positive trend. China, on the other hand, it's way up to, it's about 45% or more investment out of GDP. And all the experts, IMF and elsewhere, say that's greatly excessive. It really means that much of this investment is not producing productivity-enhancing growth, particularly domestically-oriented state-owned enterprise investment. So there's an excessive low productivity investment, and that raises problems about shifting to domestic growth, because the export industry is productive in their investment, and that's a somewhat different world. So that gets to the next one, even more striking, domestic savings as a share of GDP. Now again, India is up from about 25 to 32%, which is just about right, because investment's 34%, and then the other 2%, it's an inflow of foreign capital. Then we look at China, 57, 58% last year. I mean, the whole 58% savings rate. That's a combination of the high investment, 45%, plus the central bank last year invested about 14% of Chinese savings abroad, because that's what the central bank purchases mean. They take Chinese savings, they invest in U.S. treasuries and other things, so they have this huge savings rate. And then, you know, again, you think, well, how do you get more domestic growth? And that comes out even more in the final one, which is personal consumption as a share of GDP. And here, India's on top for one, about 60%, which again is about right. We're 70% in the U.S., but they have 10% more investment to keep the high growth, and 60% is about right. China, they're down to 37%. Imagine personally, 37%, which is just a reflection of the high savings rate. And how do you get domestic growth going when you get such a small base? You know, usually personal consumption, that's what you look at first for the bulk of your domestic growth. And there's one other implication or derivative from this chart, incidentally, it's that at this time, per capita personal consumption in India is 80% that of China, even though the Chinese economy is more than twice as large as India. It's just not much personal the personal consumption differential is so huge. So that's this basic picture of, for India, it's steady as she goes to keep the high growth, which has some obstacles, but it's for China, it's a very big restructuring. And you get out of X, because if the current account surplus starts going down $100 billion a year, and that you get a minus 3% on growth out of that. Then you got to build it up with domestic consumption from a very low base, uncertain investment sector. So it's a much, much bigger challenge, let me put it that way. But what are the obstacles? And that's that other part, which I won't go into any detail, but I have eight issues I've looked at by comparative advantage up there. You can see it's in Chapter 5. Advantage China is just the first two, infrastructure and education. These are the biggest potential obstacles for India. They're making progress on both, not enough yet, not fast enough, but things are happening, and my assessment is that the obstacles will probably not become large enough to really shift back growth to a lower level. And in any event, they don't have to change course fundamentally. They just have to go forward in each of these areas incrementally, if you will. Whereas for China, not only do they have this, they have this big restructuring, and then they have these obstacles, a major obstacle, like a dysfunctional banking sector, much more important for domestic economy than exports that don't need the domestic banking. They have the lack of rule of law and property rights, environmental pollution that has to be handled and is growing by leaps and bounds, and the corruption throughout, particularly into the at the state and local levels, related to the lack of rule of law, for example. Then there's going to be a big political problem for the restructuring, because the restructuring is going to mean a disproportionately adverse impact on the manufacturing sector, because it's all export growth. And that's where all the money is. That's where the political power is in the coastal cities. And they're going to resist it. And then finally, you have the Chinese government. And this Hu government, unlike its predecessors, is characterized as being highly risk averse, very cautious, don't want to take on contentious issues where people are in opposition. And yet, they've got all these problems. And are they really up to taking the kind of bold steps that would be required, that the IMF and others talk about, that would be able to bring about this restructuring with a minimum adverse impact or on the upward growth trend and keep the growth trend high? So that's how I came out on this 2 to 5 year projection. Great uncertainties is how the scenarios will play out in each country, particularly in China, but I think the broad conclusions of highly likely continued high growth in India and a very difficult structural adjustment and hard landing for China, I think that is a very strongly based. So now, final question, U.S. policy response, and the short answer to that question is that there is no short answer. In broadest terms, it's up there. The response needs to be forceful and comprehensive. In the short to medium term, economic policy issues will dominate, including exchange rate policy, international trade and investment policies, and a corresponding domestic economic policy agenda. Over the longer term, foreign policy and national security issues will become more important within fundamentally changed international political and economic orders. Let me see where I am here. It's all there in the book, and I won't try to get into any detail. Let me just note a few of the specific economic issues. They're the immediate, most important ones at this stage, and I want to conclude with a comment on the need for a greater sense of national purpose in this country in responding to the new situation. As for the specifics, let me say in the economic area, relationships, there are really two objectives. The one is that there are very large and growing mutual gains from trade among all of us from opening trade, particularly the so-called dynamic gains from trade, from cross-border investment and new technology application. This should benefit all of us. But at the same time, the economic policy framework in recent years has gotten way out of balance. And it's put the U.S. and some other exporters at a competitive disadvantage. And it's very important to right that balance. So the real policy response should be a combination of opening trade, gains of trade, while at the same time moving trade much more toward trade based on market-based competition rather than on government manipulation, which brings me to my first specific point, the exchange rate issue, which is by far the most important one facing us at this time, and it's definitely in the latter currency manipulation category of objectives. The International Monetary Fund proscribes currency manipulation to gain an unfair competitive advantage, particularly through protracted large-scale purchases of foreign exchange by the central bank. That's verbatim, pretty much. And China, together with some Asian countries, are so manipulating their currencies as never remotely done before. India, too, incidentally, appears to be an emerging currency manipulator, something to watch. The recommendation here, and this is Chapter 8, is that the United States, together with Europe, Canada, and others suffering the unfair commercial disadvantage, should press China and the others to take strong action, definitive actions to end this with a progressive reduction in the level of central bank purchases, ultimately down to zero, as the benchmark for whether what the results are. And if China and others resist taking these kinds of steps, then the U.S., Europe, and others should go to the WTO dispute settlement mechanism and pursue it under Article 15, which deals with exchange rate policies. In the trade field, a lot of things happening, the context being a very disappointing, or an impasse in the multilateral Doha negotiations. At the same time, a whole proliferation of free trade agreements, bilateral for the most part. And the principle, there are a lot of things on trade policy, but the major recommendation here is that the United States, together with others, should pursue a two-stage multilateral free trade agreement in non-agricultural trade. That's over 90% of merchandise trade, and other lesser objectives in agriculture services. The first stage would be further free trade agreements, and most importantly for the U.S. across the Pacific, including with Japan and India, because the alternative will be an East Asian preferential agreement leaving the United States out, and that would be very adverse for us. And in this context, of course, the congressional approval of the U.S.-Korea agreement is vital if this strategy is going to get started. The second stage, quite frankly, is just bring all these free trade bilaterals together in a integrate them in a multilateral free trade agreement in the WTO. And the timing for that second stage is very simply. It's the point at which the two largest trading nations, China and the U.S., would see fit to have free trade with each other. International investment policy, no international framework, although investment's surging forward nevertheless, but there is this new issue of sovereign investment funds where there's now public sector investors competing with private sector investors. A lot of new issues talked about here. In here, it's the focus is on China, which at this stage is a relatively small sovereign investor, feeling its way slowly forward, but likely to be number one within a few years. Because this year, Chinese foreign exchange holdings, central bank, will reach $2 trillion, on track to be $3 trillion in 2010. And that's real money by even the great Senator Dirksen standards, I would say. So there's a lot there. Plus, China, I think pretty much everybody, or close to consensus, is the most likely to use sovereign investment for strategic or even political purposes and not purely financial purposes. For example, they could focus on investing acquisition or big holdings in high-tech companies where they could have access, influence, board membership, etc. So the recommendations are, got to get on this issue more fully, Transparency is the first step, which with China is not going to be easy, let me assure you. But then there are a number of substantive issues which might require a greater regulation on the part of U.S. and other importing governments. As for the domestic economic policy agenda, it needs to address key policy issues not only on a domestic interest basis, but how it relates to international competitiveness and technological innovation, which is being competed for around the world. In recent years, our trading partners, all of them, Europe, Japan, but particularly China and India, they're taking lots of big steps to make their economies more investment-friendly, which makes us relatively less friendly. And on top of that, there are some key issues in the U.S. where our policies moved in the direction of being less rather than more friendly to investment and ultimately exports. So these main issues are addressed with some recommendations such in its Chapter 10 in the areas of education, public support for basic R&D in science and technology, corporate taxation, energy, tort reform, a couple others. So that brings me final point, which can't be overstated, I don't believe, which is the need for a greater sense of national purpose in responding to both the opportunities and the challenges in this new, brave, advanced technology world we're moving into. In India and China, it's a big contrast, the sense of national purpose and historical destiny to build these advanced technology, internationally competitive, information-based economies, it's front and center at every turn, and it's the justification to take difficult, controversial decisions, often financially costly decisions, and that's the sense of national purpose, which is decisive on these decisions. Whereas in the U.S., as I say, in contrast, there's little sense of such national purpose articulated, in my view, by the political leaders on both sides of the aisle. And decisions, therefore, to strengthen our competitive position, to strengthen our incentives for technological innovation, they languish. Very little significant steps have happened in the last few years. In fact, everything I've been talking about, everything in this book, has been virtually absent from this prolonged year and a half of presidential debates, except occasional recommendations for more protectionist policy. So what do we need? What we need? We need change. How's that for a term of art? We need change. We need change in the way we formulate our national purpose if we are going to remain at the forefront in terms of this advanced technology race, which is gathering momentum around the world and in China and India in particular. And the basic purpose of this study, if I can end on this note, is to explain with heavy supporting documentation why and how this change needs to happen. So thank you.
Okay, may I invite Jerry and Bill to join us on the podium? We're going to have comments by three distinguished experts, and then we will throw the stage open for questions. We've met Ambassador Schaefer, who is Director of South Asia Programs, and spent a career building expertise in the U.S. Foreign Service on South Asia, especially on economic issues related to South Asia. Bill Reinch is the President of the National Foreign Trade Council. He's had a distinguished career as a trade expert, highlighted by his service as Undersecretary for Export Administration at the U.S. Department of Commerce, and a long career on Capitol Hill as a trade and economic policy expert, and a member of the U.S. China Commission, along with Pat Malloy and others. Finally, our cleanup hitter will be Jerry Jasinowski, who was the former longtime head of the National Association of Manufacturers, head of the Manufacturing Institute, Jerry now serves on several corporate boards, including the Timken Company, Harsco Corporation, Phoenix Companies, and Web Methods. We're going to start with Tezzy, then go to Bill, then to Jerry.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thanks, Ernie, for both for a stirring presentation and for giving us the opportunity to have this conversation today. As you will see when you look through the book, I actually have a couple of pages of commentary in there, so I'm going to try to avoid simply duplicating what I have. I share with Ernie a basic optimism about where India is headed economically and in its international role. But let me complicate that picture a bit. I'd like to make four basic points that relate to Ernie's presentation. First, I'd like to talk about the impact of the economic changes he's discussed on India's foreign policy. Secondly, I'd like to talk about where the high-tech industry that he cites fits into the world market. Third, I'd like to mention a few of the speed bumps in the way of India's economic development, which are going to have foreign policy spillover effects themselves. And fourth, I want to give you some thoughts on where democracy fits into all of this. India's economic growth is one of four transformations of India, which have become ever more apparent since about 1990. The other three have to do with social developments, the political structure of the country, and foreign and security policy. One of the more interesting features of this economic transformation is its impact on India's foreign policy. A generation ago, no one would have argued that India's economic interests were a major factor in their foreign policy. And insofar as economics had a foreign policy fallout, what you were talking about was aid. Today, both of those statements have radically changed. The whole structure of India's foreign relations starts with the presumption that as India's economy grows, it needs to be working with the major economic powers in the world. It needs in particular to be working with the United States. And it needs to build its foreign policy on a structure that helps it get export markets, attracts investment, and above all, helps India diversify its energy supplies. So that this certainly strengthens the already existing inclination to work closely with the United States. It dramatically reduces the importance of Russia, which is still important as a military supplier, but in other respects, much less so. It makes East Asia much more important in India's world than it ever used to be. And it has even become a major factor in India's relationship with China. Although I think strategic thinkers still consider China to be India's largest strategic rival, the economic relationship is what has surged ahead in the past few years. Let me turn now to where India's high-tech industry fits, not so, both in India and in the world. There isn't really a good source of figures for the high-tech industry as a whole other than the figures that Ernie put together, and I haven't had a chance to sort of work those into the total. But the industry people like to track, which is information technology and related industries, has gone from practically nothing to 5.4% of Indian GDP in the past 6-7 years. It has continued to grow at 20% plus per year. Exports from those industries are now close to 50% of exports of goods. In the case of the United States takes most of those exports. But the other interesting feature about this, I mean, this makes that industry a big deal in India, even if 5% is only 5%. But the other interesting feature is how well tied into the world India's high-tech and related industries are. There was a speaker we had a few years ago from Stanford who took the phrase that is quite common currency in India, NRI, non-resident Indians, and said, that's not the one you need to think about, ladies and gentlemen. What you need to think about is SVI, Silicon Valley Indians. The Indian big IT companies are joined at the hip with Silicon Valley. Even if you get away from these corporate ties, my brother was a CFO of Netscape for a number of years. He told me that their engineering staff, about 30%, were Indian passport holders. And that's before you count the ones who don't have Indian passports anymore. A lot of these people, both individually and in a corporate sense, have very close linkages with the corresponding industries in India. This leads me to wonder whether, as Ernie talks about a sense of national purpose, whether there isn't also something else happening, whether you aren't also seeing the birth of a truly international industry. In some respects, this is a transition that the U.S. has already gone through. But it means that the idea of mobilizing national purpose in India may become almost immediately as difficult as it is in the United States. Any of you who've been in the U.S. government and have tried to figure out the thorny question of what is a U.S. product for purposes of pushing export promotion with your host country counterparts will know exactly what I'm talking about. The third point I wanted to mention was speed bumps. Infrastructure is an area that Ernie cited as advantage China, and that is surely the case. The inequality of India's economic growth is another. There are two aspects of this. The first is inequality by sector, which tracks pretty well with by income group. Agriculture has largely been left out of India's go-go growth. The percentage of GDP that comes from agriculture has relentlessly fallen and is now below 20%. The percentage of the population that lives on agriculture has stayed pretty much static at something over 50%. You hear 50, you hear 60. I think it's an imprecise measurement. What that's telling you is that this part of the population is getting squeezed. They're not losing income, but they're losing income share, and the income that's available to their urban counterparts is everywhere visible because there's a TV in every village. This is going to create a political backlash, which will be aggravated by the fact that when you look at it state by state, growth has been just as uneven. The high growth states are in the northwest corner of India and in the south. The low growth states, the lowest growth states, are very large, have very large parliamentary delegations, are in the sort of north central area. This poses a management problem. And I think that this is probably a more significant speed bump than the infrastructure gap, which is slowly and messily, as things happen in India, I think, being made up. That brings me to my final point, which is, where does democracy fit into all of this? When you hear Indian scholars talk about this problem, they refer to the democracy tax, which is that democracies take longer to achieve consensus. A consensus is a compromise, so it's not a nice, clean reform decision. There's a little nibbling here and a little nibbling there, so you can keep a parliamentary majority together. That also produces, as it turns out, a democracy dividend. Because once you've gone through this horrible consensus building process, you can probably keep that consensus together. That which gets decided, by and large, tends to stay decided in that system. Now, there may be another issue next week, but that's going to go through its own consensus building process. But one of the other transformations that I spoke about in India was the political transformation away from government run by one party towards coalition governments. The present coalition has over 20 parties in it. Not all of those parties are equal in either political heft or numbers, but you still have a complex process inside the coalition, which then mirrors both the unevenness by income group and the geographic unevenness of growth, so that the political basis for India's policies, be they economic, foreign policy, or anything else, is forever being shored up. This has multiple impacts on India-U.S. relations, but to talk just about the economic part of it now, we are now a maximum of 14 months away from India's next election. One of the facts of life in India is that you're never more than 3 or 4 months away from the next state-level election, and people read the tea leaves on these things to see which way the national winds are blowing. So that you're likely to be, even by India's somewhat chaotic standards, in a low reform period. Let me conclude with the thought that while democracy has been a very strong bond between India and the United States, especially in the past few years when it has amplified a growing parallelism in our foreign and security interests, it has also been a challenge for both countries because we understand each other's democracies rather poorly. There is no better example of this than the way both of our governments have handled the Civil Nuclear Cooperation Agreement. But things that Indians assume will be easy for an American government to manage politically aren't, and the reverse is also true. So that trying to deal with two democracies when it works is very satisfying, but a lot of the time it's a rather complicated and messy work in progress. Thank you, Ernie, for giving us the opportunity, and let me pass the mic to Bill Reinsch.
Thank you. Actually, that was a good point to end on because it segues into something that I was going to say. I don't have a couple pages of comments in the book. I just have a sentence in the dust jacket was my contribution. So I have nothing else to refer you to. I thought I would spend a few minutes talking about speed bumps as well, some different ones, reflecting a slightly different perspective than Daisy's. Because I think while Ernie mentions the speed bumps, and I'm not sure he does full justice to them. I don't know that he needs to, if you're looking at how you see their economies evolving going forward. But it is worth noting that there's a number of things that might very well happen, both economically as well as in the political / foreign policy spheres, that could, first of all, have a significant impact on our bilateral relationship with each of them, and also could, if not derail, then certainly postpone or otherwise confuse both countries' growth paths that Ernie has charted. And, you know, you can't predict these things with any certainty, but there certainly are things lurking out there that need to be noted. I mean, Tasey just finished talking about the unique characteristics of Indian democracy, I guess would be a good way to put it, and the difficulty in two democracies understanding each other is paralleled, I think, with our difficulty in working with the Chinese, which are not a democracy, but we also have difficulties understanding each other. I think the nuclear deal, which will have regardless of how it comes out, either way, will have a significant impact on the bilateral relationship, also illustrates the fact that you still have, I think, and I think we'll have for the foreseeable future, a decent part of the political structure in India that is simply uncomfortable dealing with the United States as a friendly party. And that's fine. I mean, there's lots of reasons for that. I mean, there's probably people here that have the same view about them. But it gets in the way of the bilateral relationship and makes some of these resolutions more difficult. Ultimately, if the deal is not approved by either party, that has a lot of implications for technology transfer and, I think, investment down the road that need to be factored in. You also have the possibility of sort of destabilizing, not third country, but destabilizing events, Kashmir being the classic Indian example, which regularly makes the top of everybody's list as the place where serious war is likely to break out in the near term. On the Chinese side, of course, you have Taiwan. We haven't yet reflected on the significance of the the most recent election and whether that will change the situation there. Which prompts me to mention, by the way, that I'm really here as a fill-in. Charles Freeman is supposed to be doing this, and he's in Taiwan. And he will no doubt have something wise to say about the election when he comes back, but in the interim, you're stuck with me. Which also reminds me to make the disclaimer that I should have made at the beginning. I'm here in my NFTC capacity, my personal capacity. I'm not representing the China Commission. There's plenty of people here who can and probably will in the Q&A period, but I'm not. So don't attribute anything I say to them. Beyond those kinds of speed bumps, I think there are a host of other issues that need to be mentioned because of the risk of stumbling, if you will, along the path that Ernie describes. And he flags a lot of them. I want to mention a couple, not because he didn't, but because I think they're worth emphasizing. The first one is the impact of the apparent Chinese decision to favor indigenous development and to limit new FDI, at least in selected sectors. I think in the long run, this is going to be a very significant decision, which we can't fully appreciate right now. In the short run, it will probably slow down incoming inward FDI, which is, I think, probably what they want for a variety of economic policy reasons. But it will have some other slowdown effects, and you'll probably see India, for lack of a better term, catching up on some fronts. But in the long term, this may be a very wise thing for them to do, looking at it from their perspective. A number of years ago, I attended a seminar that was, I believe, sponsored by one of those agencies that doesn't like to be identified. This is where all the people come up to you and say, "Hi, I'm Mike S." You know, you don't ever get quite what the rest of their name is. And the topic was the Chinese economy over the next 20 years. But the debate very quickly evolved into whether they would become essentially, continue to grow essentially as a very efficient producer of other people's products, or whether they would turn the corner, if you will, and develop design and brand name recognition and technology and innovation of their own and develop essentially a whole new economy, if you will, based on indigenous production, indigenous ideas, and indigenous creativity. The weight of opinion, and not a consensus, but the weight of opinion at that time, which was, I don't know, 01, 02, something like that, was the former and not the latter. I was inclined to think that was wrong at the time, and I think it's even more wrong now. And this decision suggests that it's going to be even more wrong in the future. I mean, the Chinese have done an important thing here, I think, in taking this decision, if they stick with it, because it will serve to significantly encourage Chinese innovation. They will be able to innovate, and that means they will compete with us and other countries, both developed and developing, in some different ways than they have been so far. And that is not simply as by making, equally good or better, but cheaper versions of American or European refrigerators or cars or whatever, but by making more innovative products that are uniquely their own, which you will also begin to see not only in consumer products, but in software and hardware design and ultimately military products and things like that. That has a lot of implications that we haven't sorted through, and I think we should. Maybe that'll be a good topic for Ernie's next book. The topic that I don't think he comments on extensively, and probably it's a fair point because it's a more recent development, is the effect of the U.S. economic slowdown on both economies. The Chinese in particular have, and this is changing, if you look at the trade data for their exports to the EU, you see a much more rapid growth in the last year or so than their exports to the United States. But a lot of their growth has been based on exports here. You've already begun to see a slowdown for any number of reasons. We don't have to get into that. But what effect this is going to have on their ability in both countries to sustain the current levels of economic growth is an important question that I think needs to be studied and looked at. I think we also need to spend more time analyzing a lot of the problems that loom for each of them that Ernie mentioned. The most obvious being energy and environment. By energy, not only how they're going to meet their own needs, which are significant because they're both net importing states in terms of total energy, certainly in terms of petroleum, but also what the spillover effect that's going to have on the rest of the world. I think personally, I think you already see that in oil prices significantly, and I think we're in for a period, the long term, of sustained tight supply, where the Chinese policy, if you will, of purchasing production capability rather than purchasing barrels, could have a significant impact on the way the global energy market plays out, and how the Indians both cope with that, and how policy response the Indians develop for themselves, faced with the same set of needs, are very important, and they're both going to have a direct bearing on what we do, and certainly on inflation and our own economy here. Likewise, on the environment, they both face extraordinary challenges, not only the physical and budgetary challenges of dealing with their problems, but frankly, but the attitudinal challenge of coming to terms with the reality that despite their relatively late arrival on the industrialization stage, they have a responsibility, just like everybody else does, to grow as cleanly and greenly, if you will, as they can. And it's all very well for them to say that, well, we didn't, which is true, but that was then, and here we are. And one of the policy debates that they're going to have to face is which you've seen particularly difficult for the Chinese, is to get them to, it's a responsible stakeholder argument, get them to see themselves as part of a larger whole, and to get them to pursue policies that that benefit the whole, and thereby themselves, and not simply policies that benefit themselves. This is going to be an historic shift in thinking for the Chinese, because they haven't really had to do that for 5,000 years, because they've tended to think of themselves as the whole. And now that they're reintegrating themselves into a much larger system, if you will, it's going to be inevitably that they're going to need to approach their own thinking about global commons issues in a way that's different. The book doesn't really, I think, address that. I don't think it needs to particularly, but it's also an issue that we're going to have to address going forward. Ernie's flagged rule of law, corruption as major issues in China. I think the debate there is going to grow as a significant issue. I don't think it's going to be a debate about democracy, but I do think it's going to be a debate about accountability. How do you have a government in China, and actually in India too, how do you have a government in both countries that, regardless of the constitutional or superficial form of it, how do you have a government that's responsive to the will of the people, to the needs of the people, that doesn't make arbitrary decisions, and a government that creates paths for redress for people who have grievances individually or collectively. The Indian process is messy. I think it's fair to say, as he's just said, it is a process, though, and you can get from A to B and ultimately to Z. The Chinese don't really have that process enshrined yet, and it's going to be a significant challenge for them to get there. And they're going to be pressed there by their own people, as I said, not, I think, by a demand for democracy, but by a demand for a government that treats its people and the issues that it faces differently. Finally, no one's mentioned the issue of demography. India is going to be the largest country in the world by 2030. The impact of that on India and the impact of the one-child policy in China and its likely evolution are also things that we need to talk about, which I could go on about, but time doesn't permit. On Ernie's policy prescriptions, I'd simply say that we've had a manufacturing crisis in our country for a long time. Productivity is up, employment is down, we've been losing jobs for more than 30 years in this sector. This isn't news. And it's not just because of China. And it's not just because of the yuan. The yen has been overvalued for a long time, too. We always seem to be dealing with undervalued currencies. And I don't have much doubt that if we rectify the Chinese problem and if we rectify the Japanese problem, which is in many respects more difficult, there will be other currencies coming along, perhaps the rupee, that will play the same game and will have the same problem. You know, I remember going to PIIE, Peterson Institute, seminars for 20 years and listening to Fred say when the yen was 250, he said when it was 150, all our problems will be solved. And then it was 150, and he said, well, when it's 100, all of our problems will be solved. Well, today it's 100, and we still have a trade deficit. And, you know, I would suggest you can have a substantial appreciation in the renminbi, and we'll still have a trade deficit. There are other factors at issue here besides the currency issue. And I'm not disagreeing with Ernie's point that it's a problem that needs to be addressed, and I'm not suggesting the way he wants to address it is wrong, but I am suggesting that it's not a sufficient solution to the problem. These problems always have to end up being dealt with in terms of domestic economic policy. And it's a fair point that that's not what the book is about. You know, but the reality is you address competitiveness problems inevitably with a tripod of issues. One, as Ernie's mentioned, you deal with job creation, job innovation, job retraining. These are the whole set of education and retraining policies that I don't have time to talk about. We tend to stop there. We don't do a very good job of that, number one. But number two, we tend to stop the conversation there and don't look beyond it. And we need to. And I think the other two things we need to look at is how do we give our companies incentives to stay here, not sticks, because those don't work, but carrots. And second, how do we do what we've always done well, which is run faster? We're dealing with two very fast-growing economies that are going to increasingly innovate. How do we innovate better? How do we innovate faster? This has been America's great strength for 200 years. Developing products, creating products, having ideas, bringing them to market, making products out of them, sometimes losing control over them, but nevertheless, out-innovating the competition. How we continue to do that is, you know, the great challenge we face. It is not, this is not the time to go into this, it is not simply because the market system in the United States has worked. There has been a heavy role in government in doing precisely this for the last 150 years. We seem to have forgotten that. But you can go sector by sector by sector and discover that the United States government has, as a matter of policy, in the 1880s, in the 1890s, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and the 1950s, as a matter of policy, decided that it wanted to encourage private sector development in a range of sectors. And if you look at those sectors now, you will see those are sectors where we continue to have some of the most competitive, not only ideas, but products in the world. We've gotten away from that in the last 20 years, and we need to get back to thinking about how you encourage America to do what it does best. That's not really in the book too much, but I flag it because I don't think we should spend all our time talking about trade policy or trade remedies as a solution to the problems that Ernie's identified, or talking about currency as a solution to the problems that Ernie's identified. They are solutions, and they're appropriate solutions. They may be necessary, but they're not sufficient. And that's where I want to leave it, except to point out that Ernie managed to get through his entire presentation without mentioning PPP once, and I give him great credit for that. Did you mention it? Then I missed it. GDP. Well, all right. I don't go into it. I was just going to say that this is a more controversial issue than Ernie's going to tell you. I'm not smart enough to comment on it, but I am smart enough to know that I don't want to be smart enough to comment on it. And I'm going to say nothing more about it, but it's an annex you ought to read carefully and then listen to the people that think he's wrong.
Thanks, Bill. Well, I think you've already heard a good bit about what I regard as a very ambitious book. I think, Ernie, you and I met back at the beginning of the Carter administration, as you pointed out when I came in, at the Economic Policy Group. And you were very ambitious, had a big appetite then, and I can't say that you've become any less ambitious. And I think the thing that this book most suggests to you is, boy, this is a big book. It covers a lot of territory. And I suppose some people could make a criticism of that. I really think that there are so few people who are trying to gain the big picture on this that I see it as a very positive effort, because it attempts to put into a framework what's going on in China, what's going on in the United States vis-a-vis China, and it also is pretty comprehensive with respect to India. So my hat is off to you for your ambitious effort to try to put all this together. In terms of making any comments on it, I would just choose to make three or four points that I think draw on Ernie's book to emphasize what I think is the most important set of developments with respect to both China and India and the United States. I think the first first point I would really make with respect to priorities is the point you make, and your numbers are very definitive, about the extraordinary growth in this part of the world
and how much of it is tied to the United States as well as exports. And I would add my note to Bill's that it works both ways, because I think the United States and our slowdown is going to have very dramatic effects on both India and China. And so what you have had over the last 5 years is the most extraordinary example of global growth in my memory, much of it driven by China, first and foremost, so that when you sit in manufacturing companies around the world and energy companies, what you say is, we have had this massive Chinese boom, and then we've had this massive infrastructure boom that goes beyond China and India. That's what's driven the global economy. And I think secondarily, an extraordinary amount of financial capital from around the world and from the U.S. has helped to do that. I would suggest that the current financial crisis we have in the U.S. is the most serious we've had since the Great Depression, and it's a long way from being over, and that financial crisis is going to have a tail which will have major effects on both China and India. And so what you have is really two simultaneous things going on, a very positive set of global growth developments driven by China, and secondarily beginning to be driven somewhat by India, a lot of it infrastructure and energy and commodity based, and it really has dominated what's been going on. And now secondly, coming in, and it really is not something that Ernie could have addressed, but nevertheless has to be taken into account, what is going to be a very serious long-term financial adjustment on the part of the U.S. that's going to have effects back on China and India. I think with respect to China, I would certainly say that your emphasis on the exchange rate is absolutely central, and I think the numbers that you use to indicate why that exchange rate change has to occur because of current account surpluses as well as other factors, and the solution that you suggest using the WTEO and the suggestion you make that it be phased in over a number of years is all right on point and very sound. I remember working closely with the early stage of the Bush administration and manufacturers and China and the exchange rate issue and Fred and others, and I think there wasn't a sufficient appreciation for the kind of solution that was required because of their financial problems, and that it had to be a multi-year solution, and it would have to be something that went beyond the U.S. and involve other actors in the global economy such as the IMF and the WTO, and I think you've done that, and I think that is the most important thing that must occur if we're going to get a better set of relations in a level playing field between the U.S. and China. I think many of the other things that you mentioned, Ernie, I'm less inclined to put a high priority on. You don't make a big deal out of it in the book, but you do make a big deal out of it in your other writings and your general comments, and that is intellectual property. Well, we must keep a high priority on improving the intellectual property environment in China. That is really a long-term slog. When you look at the legal system and you look at the regional divides within China, we should keep at it, and the joint ventures and the fact that we're going to have more and more Chinese companies coming to the fore will help us, but it ain't going to be quick, and I think that it is not as important as the currency issue and the financial issues between China and the United States. Another thing I particularly liked about the book, Ernie, is the very careful work you've done in terms of trying to show why the growth rates might change and why the Chinese growth rate is going to slow down. And I totally was taken by your set of arguments. I think that will happen. I think that there are problems emerging in an economic sense that are becoming more serious with respect to China's macroeconomic situation, which is part of the reason that they need to make the exchange rate adjustment as much as anything else. But even if they should do that, I see their growth rates slowing down the shift to indigenous corporations and domestic growth rather than export growth is one reason. There are a number of others, and I think that we are going to see and have more problems with respect to China than we are with respect to India. I thought that the comments on India were very much on point and tend to suggest a relatively positive outlook, but one that's going to move a lot slower, and that's just the price of democracy that several people have suggested. They have had this big speed bump of infrastructure, but I must say they do seem to be moving forward to address that now in a way which does suggest, at least to a lot of American companies, that there are opportunities now in India that are perhaps somewhat better than the opportunities in China. I can't tell you the number of American firms that I'm in contact with and talk to that, although they're putting a high priority, as you would guess, on China, they are shifting more and more of their attention to India. And just 5 years ago, you couldn't get them to really do that. So the reforms in India have had a remarkably quick effect on both India and the perception of India in the U.S. Corporate and governmental system. And I think that's very noteworthy, but at the same time, it is going to go slow. And anybody who thinks it's not just hasn't spent enough time in and around the Indian environment to know. And the things like infrastructure and other things simply take a great deal of time. I think that the thing that I liked best about the book, and there was many things in addition to it being a very comprehensive, ambitious undertaking, was the point you made on page 15 in the summary, where you talk about I may have the page wrong. Let's be sure I've got the page right. On page 15, where you make this point about national purpose, I mean, what has struck me by my observance of China and the United States and India over the last 10 or 15 years is the extent to which, particularly with respect to China, that they are really serious about what they're doing with respect to economic growth, rebuilding their country, improving their education system, doing all the things they need to do in order to put themselves into a fully competitive global position. I mean, the determination and focus of the Chinese leadership is simply breathtaking. When you look at the U.S. political leadership, Ernie cites the recent debate being absent any focus on this, but if you go back to the Bush administration, you would find an insufficient priority as well. And the Congress and the American political system in general, until we have a higher focus on the national purpose of being more competitive vis-a-vis the rest of the world, and in particular China, we are not going to be able to blame the exchange rate or any other things for our failure to be on a level playing field. So I think that although that's part of the ambitious aspect of the book, it is nevertheless the most important, and I think that all of us need to, within the United States, continue to press for more national purpose attention on that issue. All in all, Ernie, I congratulate you.
Thanks, Jerry, and thanks to all of our commentators. We have a few minutes for questions in the back of the room. Sir, can you identify yourself? And
thank you, Raghuveer Goyal, for India Globe in Asia Today. That's a great presentation. My quick question is that there's a competition between India and China, and India, world's largest democracy, on the other hand, China, world's largest communism. Do you see any confrontation between the two and where the U.S. stands in this triangular relationship?
I'm going to yield to Tezi for the most part. As Tezi mentioned, at this stage, most of the engagement is on the economic side, which is both mutual gains and some conflicts, and the currency issue comes into this relationship as well. In terms of broader relationships, I think India is still basically pursuing its long-standing policy of independence and not becoming as engaged, although I'll just say there is clearly been deepening ties between the U.S. and India, including between our militaries, where the military establishment institutions, I've been in one myself, very close ties across countries. And just one comment I heard recently on this: for all the decades of Soviet armaments and connections with India, there were never very many personal ties between Soviet and Indian officers for various reasons. Whereas with Americans, you've got common values, and you've got English language, etc. So I think it's there, and sub rosa, there certainly is an understanding that U.S. and India somehow or another might balance China, but that's never stated publicly. Beyond that, though, perhaps Tezi has something.
I think there is an underlying rivalry between India and China, one that's more important to India than it is to China. But mostly, India wants to engage with China. The United States does too. Neither one wants to pick a fight with China or to turn China into an enemy. So I don't think you're looking at an emerging confrontation. What you're more likely to be looking at is a version of balance of power politics.
Hi, Ernie, thank you very much. And it's really a marvelous book. I haven't read it, but I look forward to it. I certainly have a great understanding, a really deep appreciation of what you tried to accomplish, and appreciate it very much. The question is, there are so many questions to ask, but you said the WTO had failed. I'd rather put it that the members of the WTO have failed the goals and purposes of the organization. And two of the baddest of those actors are India and China. And the question is, why is it that India, which has been pursuing policies of liberalization domestically, has been so resistant to committing itself to bind its existing levels of liberalization in the WTO, as well as making new steps toward liberalization to expand trade? I'm Bob Bastien of the Coalition for Service Industries.
Well, I go into this, Bob, when you get to hopefully reading at least parts of the book, I get into this a great deal in Chapter 8. And I've been through this, as you know, for several decades where the Indians are just impossible.
So what's the distillation?
The distillation is that there's now, I'm trying to find my quote on this.
In your own words.
In my own words. That in the last few years, Indian trade policy has been a fundamental contradiction. You have the people in Geneva who have just been stonewalling, as they always have, in WTO, and then you have the people at home that are opening to trade investment, not as fast as we would like. They have an amazing free trade agreement functioning with Singapore, which has a lot of investment trade. They are negotiating free trade agreements officially with EU and ASEAN. They have unilaterally reduced a wide range of their tariffs down from 10% from 80 or 90%. And the whole analytic context of the reform strategy is open trade and investment, market-oriented. So there is this fundamental conflict. And in fact, in that annex I referred to, this is in the trading system as itself. What's going on in Doha round was kind of fatally flawed to sort of mercantilist, that it's not in developing countries, is not in their interest to liberalize trade. And it goes on and on, whereas in a free trade agreement, it's the exact opposite. The developing countries, even the poorest countries like Honduras and Nicaragua, they go to zero, we go to zero in a mutual interest. So it's one reason I come out the way I do is that it's a whole different conversation that way. And it also is private sector versus public sector, and I raise that in the chapter. There are discussions, there have been, between NAM and CII, Confederation of Indian Industry, on free trade agreement, non-agriculture, and they're now in the OECD in the Trade Advisory Committee. So things are changing, both in terms of the private sector's broad view, which is more open trade, and they're having more influence, I think, in government, and this fundamental conflict between what you hear in these Doha meetings and what you're hearing in other areas. I don't want to overstate how fast they're moving, and I know in the services sector you're having big problems, but let me just say in services, somewhere in the book, I think it's 05, only 2 or 3 years ago, there was a bilateral air transportation agreement, which is the most open skies agreement we've ever negotiated. It's way ahead of China because it's unlimited flights in both directions, both any companies. And as you know, in financial services and marketing, a lot of it's a struggle within the economy for private Chinese banks to get a bigger role. And then, so it's moving slowly, but it's very different from what we've heard for 40 or 50 years in the GATT and the WTO from the Indian trade reps.
Bob, think about the difference between grand trade policy pronouncements in the United States and the reality of textile negotiations. Transpose that into India, and you've got the explanation for what Ernie just said.
We've got time for one more. There's a question in the back. Joe?
Show Chandra with Bloomberg News. Quick question on, I think, was it Bill who made a reference to the implications if the Indo-U.S. civil nuclear agreement doesn't go forward? What I'm wondering, Ernie, you and anybody else on the panel would like to comment, to what extent do you think, if the agreement doesn't go through, it would really affect the decision of American companies to invest in India or continue to invest in India and to do more business with India in terms of trade? Or do you think we have passed that stage and it really won't matter when it comes to real business? Thank you.
Again, maybe Desi and I can each answer. We may have somewhat different answers this time. My own feeling is that if it does not, aside from a GE and a Westinghouse, people with direct irons in the fire, that this shouldn't influence the way other American companies are strategizing toward India and setting up their big campuses there and getting, and even GE has very broad-ranging interests in India and infrastructure and all kinds of equipment besides civil nuclear. So it's a setback in certain areas, in certain specific areas, But I don't think it's going to slow down the momentum that's building, and I think Jerry's point was extremely important, that discussion boardrooms today about India is very different from what it was 5 years ago. But Tezi, you may have a different view about the civil nuclear agreement.
Actually, I don't. I think that the cost that India is going to pay if it decides that it can't move ahead for all of the domestic political reasons that have been on full display for the past several months is going to be in a different realm. I think there's going to be some sense in the political world that India isn't comfortable making the kinds of choices one has to make when one is playing in the global big leagues. Individual company transactions will probably go through. There may be some people in the infrastructure and related areas who become a little bit more hesitant, but I don't see that as being a major factor. It's mostly the absence of something that could be a big plus.
Jerry might have a comment. I think it's really the same as my two colleagues have suggested. Companies are simply not going to use that as a principal criteria for their decision about locating and investing and doing business with India. There are other factors, right now infrastructure being the most important. But there are many other factors that are very important. So it's not an issue.
Okay. You've been a very patient audience. Let me thank you for joining us here today. I want to thank Ambassador Schaefer and CSIS for hosting us today and being our co-sponsor of this program. I want to thank Jerry and Bill for joining us. and for their excellent commentary. Finally, Ernie, thanks for a good piece of work.
And thank you for supporting me through all this.
So, thank you.